Of note, not long after this interview, osimertinib was approved by the FDA specifically in patients with T790M EGFR tumor mutations who've received other prior EGFR TKI therapy. I next met with Dr. Jean-Charles Soria, and to begin, he presented a patient from his practice.
This case describes a 60-year-old former smoker patient with a history of 55 pax year that has developed squamous cell carcinoma of the lung. This gentleman, who was PS1, was treated by cisplatin gemcitabine for 2 cycles, and the first CT scan evaluation demonstrated a clear PD in all the different lesions. Chemotherapy was well tolerated, but because we had a clear failure of the initial doublet platinum-based chemotherapy, we really were not very keen to offer him a second-line chemotherapy.
Could you just comment a little bit about your approach outside a trial setting to the first-line therapy of metastatic squamous cell? This patient got cisgem. What are the other alternatives that you've considered? And I'm also curious about your thoughts in terms of nab-paclitaxel, which has been positioned to some extent as maybe something to consider in squamous cell.
Yeah, so basically, cisplatin gem is probably the most popular regimen used in Europe for squamous cell carcinoma. Carboplatin is the alternative. Nab-paclitaxel is something that is pretty popular in the United States, but you have to know that outside the US, nab-paclitaxel is not available. It's not approved in Canada, it's not approved in any EU country. So while it appears as appealing, and especially appealing because there is no steroids use, its availability is restricted to the United States.
You mentioned the fact that corticosteroids are not used. To what extent is that an advantage? You hear people going back and forth about that, both in terms of acute issues, but also the fact that nowadays when people see a patient with metastatic squamous cell, the main thing on their mind is, when can I get them on a checkpoint inhibitor? And do you think there's any advantage in using an agent prior to that that doesn't have corticosteroids?
Well, I don't think in real life having corticosteroids before a checkpoint inhibitor is going to change anything. But of course, when you want to combine the immune checkpoint with chemotherapy, being able to use something that does not mandate corticosteroids is extremely important. And this is why in the development of the anti-PD-L1 antibodies, atezolizumab, one of their major randomized phase 3 trials is comparing chemotherapy with nab-paclitaxel versus atezo plus nab-paclitaxel. And the foundation of that is this is the only combination which is steroid-free.
What in general do we know at this point in terms of corticosteroids and the potential to interfere with checkpoint inhibitors? Sometimes corticosteroids are given for toxicities, pneumonitis, et cetera. Do we know what the impact of that is?
Well, if we take the question in general context, we know that steroids at high doses above 1 mg/kg are the therapy for autoimmune diseases. So we know it's a very powerful way to wash out the immunity that can trigger when you have autoimmune diseases, thyroiditis, colitis, hepatitis. So therefore, intuitively, it's pretty obvious that if you can avoid concomitant use of steroids with immune checkpoints, it's better. Now the situation will be pretty different, whether it is before or at the very initiation of immune checkpoints, or once you have already been loaded with 2 or 3 doses. Because we know that once you have been loaded with immune checkpoint blockade, the army of sleeping lymphocytes has been already raised. So you can throw some steroids, but the army is still there. So I think we need to really focus on the negative aspect of steroids, pretty different when we are in the setting of pre-immune checkpoint users, early immune checkpoint users, where you really want to avoid it, versus a patient who got already 2 or 3 doses of immune checkpoint, which probably have raised already the army. And in that setting, yes, you decrease toxicity, but you still keep some of the activity.
Interesting. So this patient unfortunately had disease progression fairly quickly, actually after 2 cycles. At that point, what was his clinical situation? Where was the disease and was he symptomatic from it?
Yeah, this patient had a significant involvement inside the thorax, and the liver mets were the most important concern. Thanks God, this patient was PDE, but not heavily symptomatic. Although, you know, we had a almost 50% increase in the liver mets, and it was pretty clear in my mind that he will come off the wagon very rapidly if we didn't find a very efficient second-line therapy.
So what happened next?
So, as I said, because frontline chemo was a complete failure, we decided not to offer a second-line chemotherapy, which could have been, for instance, docetaxel, and we decided to offer him an immune checkpoint blocker. And at that time point, nivolumab was available in France through the expanded access program. This patient had no history of autoimmune disease with the exception of vitiligo, but people have to know that vitiligo is not at all a contraindication of immune checkpoint blockers. I have seen debates going on where they say, oh, he has vitiligo, that's an autoimmune problem. It is not considered as a serious autoimmune problem. On the contrary, there are some papers that have recently suggested that patients who have baseline vitiligo tend to have better response to immune checkpoint blockers.
How extensive was his vitiligo?
It wasn't much, but enough to see it because it was partially in the face, so it becomes obvious, and to some extent in his arms, but it was limited.
I'm trying to remember the mechanism of how vitiligo occurs.
Well, apparently it's some T cells that have an activity against melanocytes and therefore leads to depigmentation. And it is, as you know, a disease that when you are young and have it in your face can have profound psychological implications. In this case, the gentleman was 65 years old. He had no problem with his vitiligo. He was living with it more than 20 years.
Interesting. In terms of this issue of autoimmune disease and the contraindications, particularly in metastatic lung cancer, where, you know, a patient like this is obviously in serious trouble, I'm curious, I don't know if you've had cases of people with Crohn's disease or neurologic autoimmune diseases. What are some of the issues that have come up and, you know, how do you resolve it?
That's a very important question because we need to realize that the data presented as of today regarding the tolerability of immune checkpoint blockers is based on patients that have been enrolled in clinical trials, and therefore very strict inclusion criteria have been applied to them. And now these drugs are out there in the real world. I don't think most of my colleagues are making extremely detailed questionnaires about, do you have some autoimmune disease? Have you ever had some thyroiditis? Have you ever had psoriasis? I think if the patient brings up the matter, then you're going to say, oh, maybe this is not a good candidate. But I have personally seen recently a case in our institution where the patient just forgot to tell us that he had psoriasis 5 years ago. And it was a nightmare because after the first infusion of nivolumab, he developed an extremely severe 50% of the surface psoriasis that led to an ICU.
Wow.
And we were unable to continue an immune checkpoint blockade. So I really think we need to apply some common sense on what is the level of autoimmune disease that the patient had in his life, how florid and symptomatic was this, and thyroid. I mean, if the patient had already a thyroiditis, I personally don't care because the therapy of thyroiditis is obvious. I mean,
absolutely.
If you get hyperthyroiditis when you have the lymphocytes infiltrating your thyroid, you just give them some beta blockers. And then when the thyroid function decreases and you are in hypothyroidy, you give thyroxine. On the opposite, when you have extensive psoriasis, this is not a joke. I mean, if it expands, it's not easy to treat.
What about Crohn's disease? That's not uncommon.
Crohn's disease, unfortunately, apparently is a pretty serious situation because you can really aggravate Crohn's disease. And in fact, when you look at the literature, the people who are really good experts on autoimmune-induced colitis are all people coming from the Crohn area. And what they told me, and that's a sentence that really captured my imagination, is that with immune checkpoint blockers, you create Crohn disease that mimics the history of Crohn over 20 years.
Wow.
So in a few shots, you get what you got in 20 years of Crohn disease. So I think it's a true issue. And I really think that if I had one piece of advice for colleagues that are using immune checkpoint blockers, is really not to underestimate the risk of diarrhea and to make sure the patient understands that when you are with an immune checkpoint blocker and diarrhea happens, the worst you can do is start taking loperamide because things are going to get worse. And it's not obvious. When you go to an emergency room, you say, I'm a cancer patient, I have diarrhea. Most of the doctors are going to give you something to stop the transit and not steroids.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, the PD-1 antibodies have a pretty good reputation as opposed to the anti-CTLA-4, ipilimumab, et cetera. And yet we have heard cases of colitis. Have you actually had anybody in your practice?
Yeah, we have. I mean, on over 100 patients treated, we have had 2 cases. And of course, this is not as bad as CTLA-4 because CTLA-4 had a much higher rate of almost 20%. And these colitis were extremely severe. The PD-1s, they can happen, but I think when they happen, they tend not to be as bad as the ones with CTLA-4. With CTLA-4, what you need to know is not only the colitis are severe, but they are definitive. Even with the therapies, even with steroids, even with anti-TNF compounds, these people keep the colitis for life. That's not the case with PD-1s.
Interesting. But, you know, you look at a patient like this one, going through chemotherapy, 2 cycles progressing, a lot of disease. What would you estimate his life expectancy would be at that point, typically?
I mean, typically below 6 months, clearly.
Because, you know, in that kind of a situation, I mean, for example, you think about your psoriasis patient. If you had to do it all over again and you were faced in this kind of situation, I don't know, you know?
That's a very tricky call. I think psoriasis I won't do because I have been very impressed by how bad my patient did. Crohn disease, I probably will take the risk because I think the guidelines of management of autoimmune colitis are much more well identified. Steroids or anti-TNF are very powerful. Diffuse psoriasis is a nightmare. There is no standard of care that is easy.
So I'll give you a second opinion case of a patient who's actually discussed on the same audio program that you're going to be on by John Haymock. I just interviewed him last night about this. And again, same kind of situation, very bad disease, very bad prognosis. The patient has controlled but pretty bad multiple sclerosis.
I think also in multiple sclerosis, we have many new therapies that are available. And I would feel probably pretty much inclined to discuss the use of an immune checkpoint blocker. But the patient has to be aware of what is at stake, correct? If your survival is below 6 months and you have multiple sclerosis that can deteriorate, I think the worst toxicity is to die from your disease.
Do you know if any patients have been treated with MS?
Not in my practice.
What about Guillain-Barré or a history of Guillain-Barré?
Yeah, I think that's a very severe one. We have one patient in the melanoma experiencing Gustave Roussy, who died of Guillain-Barré.
And yeah, I've heard about a couple of cases
yes,
like that.
And that was really a very, very difficult case for all the team because he was almost in 80% PR and still he died.
Wow. So this patient then did not have a contraindication to using a checkpoint inhibitor, and I see he got nivolumab.
Absolutely. And we were extremely happy. This patient got nivolumab infused every 2 weeks, and recommendations is to do the first CT scan at week 12. But by week 8, he was complaining of increased abdominal pain in the liver region, and therefore we did a CT scan. And then we were really unhappy because it was clearly progressing. And we told the patient, you know, this is an early CT scan, it might be pseudoprogression, we need to wait a little bit. And we're going to do again a CT scan at week 12. This happened. And unfortunately, not only we confirmed progressive disease in the lung and in the liver, but also deterioration of liver transaminases.
Any new lesions?
This patient had a growth of most of the large lesions in the liver and indeed appearance of new small lesions in the liver. So the situation was pretty bad. We had an extensive discussion in the multidisciplinary board. We had a discussion with the radiologist, and the global feeling was that the clinical status was going down. The laboratory measurements were in the wrong direction. We had 2 consecutive CT scans showing progressive disease. So we say this is not pseudoprogression. This is unfortunately true progression, which, you know, happens to more than half of the patients.
Yeah, most patients will have progression. And this patient looks like he was having pretty rapid progression before treatment, and it just looks like it continued right through. You mentioned, though, the issue of pseudoprogression. Can you talk a little bit about how you think that through? Is this a true pseudo progression, or is this just that it takes the therapy a while to catch up, that it's actually progression?
Yeah, so as you know, pseudo progression has been pretty well described in melanoma. There is debate in the lung community first to define the prevalence of pseudo progression. We review 120 cases in Gustave Roussy, and in our experience, pseudo progression in lung is 10%. It's not a lot, but you need to keep it in mind.
So let's get back to your patient, though. In a very common situation, a patient's had first-line chemo, has had second-line checkpoint inhibitor, now with progressive disease. In general, what are the options that might be considered in this situation?
Well, in that situation, the options are either oral TKI, erlotinib, afatinib, or you can try chemotherapy. Already, chemotherapies have been registered for the second line and not the third line, but in this case, you could argue docetaxel. For this patient, we decided...
Could I just, before you go on, when we get into this patient, just to sort of flesh that out a little bit. So, do you say docetaxel?
Yes.
Okay. Any thoughts about the possibility of using ramucirumab with docetaxel?
Yeah, absolutely. Ramucirumab plus docetaxel is an option, but it's in theory for second line setting, not third line. But you could argue, especially because this guy has liver mets and anti-angiogenic compounds have demonstrating pretty interesting responses in the liver mets. I don't know if you have followed the literature in colorectal cancer, but there is very interesting data from MD Anderson and some Swiss centers demonstrating that patients borderline for surgery with colorectal cancer and liver mets are amenable to surgery with a combination of FOLFOX with bevacizumab.
Wow, I did not know that. That is really, liver mets, that's amazing. Yeah. Very interesting. I haven't seen that. In any event, I'm curious, is ramucirumab approved in Europe?
Ramucirumab is currently being evaluated by EMEA. The translation from that central approval to a country-specific approval is ongoing.
What are your thoughts about the risk-benefit ratio of adding in ramucirumab, even in non-squamous as well as squamous, such as this patient? How do you think, putting aside the regulatory and financial issues, how do you think it plays out from a cost-benefit point of view?
Well, I think it's an option that needs to be discussed in light of the status of the patient. In this situation, the patient is third line. He started PS1, he became PS2. His liver enzymes have increased. His general condition has decreased. I think he is a very bad candidate for a combination of docetaxel ramucirumab because the neutropenia increases with that combination, fibrinogen neutropenia increases with that combination. I would be very, very worried to take him off the wagon. We know we are heading towards a bad outcome for this patient. So I would rather prefer something that is going to keep his quality of life by trying in parallel to control to some extent the tumor.
So you mentioned the possibility, and obviously this patient has a wild-type tumor.
Yes, this patient has no oncogene actionable alteration, and therefore we discussed the options and we thought that an oral therapy was something that makes sense.
Any thoughts about the Virostrat assay? Maybe you could explain what that is that's been studied actually and amazingly in a phase 3 trial. I mean, incredible. What you think about the findings there and whether you think it's something that might be considered in this kind of situation?
Well, Virostrat is a blood-based test that aims at providing a score that tells you whether the patient is more likely to benefit from erlotinib. I think there is some interesting data out there. To my surprise, the uptake of this has been pretty low, at least in Europe. I don't know of any clinician, except a few in Italy who are pretty involved with the Virostrat development, that are doing this in a daily practice. I think the community has a sense that outside squamous cell carcinoma, so for non-squamous patient, EGFR mutation is the true molecular predictor, so they don't really buy the Virostrat. Now, in the squamous patient, you are probably right. Maybe that's an area where we should be asking that. We performed a trial with Glenwood Goss called the LuxLung-8 trial, and this trial was reported at last ASCO. This is a trial that randomized in the second-line setting patients between erlotinib and afatinib for squamous cell carcinoma. We are reporting at this World Lung Cancer Conference a comprehensive analysis with the Foundation Medicine platform or over 200 patients demonstrated that we did not find any subgroup that had higher advantage as compared to the overall population. So afatinib was better to erlotinib in all the molecular subgroups we found. We demonstrated that EGFR mutations do not explain why afatinib is better. But going to your point, we have engaged recently on a very strict analysis of hundreds of samples of the trial, and we hope to be able to share this with the community in the upcoming months.
Could you talk a little bit more about the data in terms of when you say there was an advantage, how much of an advantage there was for afatinib?
Oh, there was a clear advantage for afatinib as compared to erlotinib in terms both of response rate, although that was not statistically significant, in terms of disease control rate, in terms of PFS, and in terms of overall survival, although some might argue that it was marginal because it was 1.2 months of extra overall survival, but it was statistically significant. And what really convinced me that this was really a better alternative is that the quality of life for the afatinib arm was better than erlotinib. And a lot of people argue afatinib is a terrible drug. It gives you a lot of diarrhea. It gives you a lot of stomatitis. Well, sure, it gives you more diarrhea, more stomatitis than erlotinib. But when you ask patient-reported outcomes, because probably it's a better tumor therapy than erlotinib in squamous, the overall balance is that they have a better quality of life with afatinib than with erlotinib.
You know, I thought that was really an incredible data set because a lot of people, I think, sort of wrote off the whole issue of EGFR TKIs and wild-type disease. And this study makes you rethink that. What's the theoretical mechanism of action?
I think a lot of people have forgotten that the BR21 trial done by Francis Shepard that led to the registration of erlotinib had an hazard ratio that was better in squamous than in non-squamous. They forgot that. Even if you look at the subgroup of male smokers squamous, the trial is positive. And I think afatinib is superior to erlotinib because in a disease which is full of different mutations, in squamous cell carcinoma, you don't have many clear drivers. Cutting the signal transduction by blocking HER1, HER2, and HER4, that's what afatinib is doing. It's a pan-HER inhibitor. Probably is better than just blocking HER1, just because, you know, you are blocking the different routes of tumor growth.
But that's fascinating. So you're going to go back to the same patients and apply the VeriStrat assay?
Yes.
That's awesome. It reminds me of what they did with Oncotype and breast cancer, where they went back to the NSABP randomized trials and put that marker in. That's really interesting. When I think about VeriStrat, it seems so empiric. You know, there's a bunch of proteins. I mean, do you have any feel for what it's really testing for?
I have no idea, in fact.
But, you know, you never know. Maybe there's something's going to come up with this. When do you think you'll have data on that?
I hope that we will have the data by the end of the year or early next year. Therefore, we hope we will be able to share this with the community in some of the meetings next year.
Wow, that's really exciting. I'll be looking forward to hearing that. You mentioned the, quote, bad reputation that afatinib has. Can you talk about what your experience is with the drug? And I don't know what regulatory confines you might be under, but in the United States, now actually we have three choices, I guess. Gefitinib, I guess, is now available, afatinib and erlotinib. But particularly in terms of afatinib as opposed to erlotinib, what have you seen in your own practice?
We have the same choices in the EU for EGFR mutant patients. As you know, afatinib and gefitinib are not allowed in EGFR wild-type patients, while erlotinib is. Maybe with the LuxLong-A data, afatinib will also be registered in squamous and therefore allowed in EGFR wild-type patients. Going back to what is my impression, it's very simple. There is a gentleness in terms of side effects that is very good for gefitinib, then it starts to be a little less good with erlotinib and is a little less good with afatinib. Now, that being said, we also need to take into account efficacy, correct? You cannot just make your decision based on toxicity. And there is intriguing data regarding the afatinib efficacy on exon 19 mutations. This needs to be sorted out. And there is a trial comparing now prospectively afatinib versus gefitinib. We hope that is going to give us some idea. I think right now it's very difficult to pick up one of the EGFR inhibitors for a mutant patient. And my personal take is I really discuss with the patient the tox profile and what has been reported in terms of activity. and then the patient picks it up. And it really depends who the patient is. You have profiles of people who say, I don't care about dogs, give me the most powerful one. And I heard that you are telling me that afatinib has been compared with CISPEM, which is the most powerful comparator, and even their OS is better for exon 19.
So what's this patient's current situation?
Well, this patient has been put on afatinib for the different reasons we discussed, and notably the recent LuxLong 8 data that demonstrated superiority of afatinib versus erlotinib. He was prescribed afatinib with concomitant loperamide. I never wait for diarrhea to happen. I'll tell the patient, these pills goes with this pill.
How much loperamide?
One pill a day. And then I tell him, if loose stools happen, you take another loperamide. But my personal take, and this is not in the label, but in my personal experience, and I have some experience with afatinib because we have been using it for many years now in different clinical trials, is that if you concomitantly give afatinib with loperamide, things are much better. And in fact, if you look at neratinib, which is another PAN-HER inhibitor, when they implemented systematic loperamide, their grade 3 grades dropped by 4.
Interesting. So how long has he been on it?
He's now almost 4 months.
Really?
Disease never shrinked, but is stabilized. Of course, it's a precarious situation, but, you know, it is an option that is pretty interesting.
Any side effects from the afatinib? Any diarrhea?
He has had grade 1 diarrhea intermittently. He has had one episode of stomatitis that was pretty well managed by mouthwashes with steroids. And the second time he got some stomatitis, we were very, very impressed by the activity of laser. Buccal laser is something that is used by our colleagues in hematology all the time.
What is it?
A pen. It's a pen with a laser.
Huh.
And you can really decrease the pain. I'm very surprised. I wasn't aware of all this literature. But there is very robust literature out there demonstrating that when you're going to make an allograft transplantation, treating with laser any kind of mucositis is extremely powerful in terms of pain control.
Who does it?
Well, it's done in most of the hematological sites by the nurses.
Wow.
And I really think we as lung cancer doctors, we need to start thinking, well, if a pen costs 5,000 euros and then you pay another 100 euros per year to keep it in good shape, why are we not using
a laser
pen? Yeah, laser pen.
So did you do that with this patient?
Well, I did that with this patient.
Really?
And you know, what is key is not that the ulcer went away rapidly, is that the pain disappeared almost immediately.
Wow.
And I really think we need to pay attention to these things because I will always remember one of my patients who was on an mTOR inhibitor therapy.
That's what I was just thinking, mTOR inhibitors.
Yeah, of course, notably for breast. And he told me, I will never forget you, Dr. Soria, because I used to have cancer, but no side effects. Then I met you and you gave me this mTOR inhibitor and I became a cancer patient with permanent side effects because every time I swallow my saliva, I had a nice thought for you. And I say, Ma, we really need to treat this more proactively.
Wow.
Come on. It was a very painful statement, believe me. It really opened my eyes.
Wow, yeah.
And then I say, you know, stomatitis is a pain because this patient, every time he swallowed, he had pain. And then he had bad feelings for me, which, you know, hurts me because I was trying to do something good. And who cares if it hurts me? In fact, it's a statement of the patient that stomatitis is a side effect that is really very disabling for his social life. He couldn't go outside and have dinner with others. He couldn't go and have beers with others. He was really, you know, home-oriented because of that. And in the European culture, you know how much we like food.
Wow, I got to tell my breast cancer colleagues about that one. That's really interesting. Yeah, because, you know, that's really been a major issue in terms of everolimus and breast cancer for sure, not to mention other diseases. So, well, that's very interesting about this patient. Why don't we finish out with your 75-year-old lady with the exon 19 mutation?
Sure. So I'm going to describe a lady, 75-year-old, that had an EGFR mutation and exon 19. This lady was addressed to me after multiple lines of therapy. In fact, she initially got cisplatin-gemcitabine combination, followed by gefitinib, followed by erlotinib, followed by experimental drug that is no longer in development called BMS-514, which was a EGFR-VGFR inhibitor, and then she was put on neratinib. When she arrived to my clinic, we offered the lady a new biopsy to confirm the presence of the T790M acquired resistance mutation. In that setting, today, we have two main drugs available either through clinical trials or expanded access programs. These two drugs are ruxolitinib or AZD9291. In this specific case, the patient was put on AZD9291 through the expanded access program because at the time point she came to me, the EAP was not available for ruxolitinib. It was available for AZD9291 in France. And this has been a really honeymoon for the patient because she's now 8 months on this drug with limited side effects, rash grade 1, and she's extremely happy.
How did she compare this experience to the side effects, particularly in terms of the skin, when she was on gefitinib and also erlotinib?
I mean, she said clearly that compared to erlotinib, this is much better. Compared to the gefitinib, this was marginally better, but still better. So she's very happy, you know. And here we have a lady that has been rolling from one TKI to another TKI for 5 consecutive lines without chemo. And believe me, she is not ready at 75 years old to go back to chemotherapy immediately. We will see what will happen because we know now that resistance also kicks in after AZD9291. At this meeting at World Lung Cancer, there is presentations on acquired new mutations of resistance to ruxolitinib and AZD9291. And according to the mutations, the therapies are pretty different. If you develop a new C797S mutation without T790M still being present, surprise, gefitinib or erlotinib are going to work again.
Really?
Although AZD9291 or ruxolitinib don't work.
Wow.
But if you develop that same mutation but keep the T790M, there is no tyrosine kinase inhibitor that has activity.
So let me process this. What's the chance that on progression of these third generation agents, you're going to have the T790M negative?
Well, it's pretty interesting. Around 40% of the patients develop an acquired resistance, although their T790M has been completely wiped out. So the drug is so powerful, it destroys the main resistant clone, and there is a new clone that emerges that because AZD and ruxolitinib are covalent binders, it's going to block the site of binding. But for erlotinib and gefitinib, which are not covalent binders, that mutation has no effect. So it's pretty strange that you can go back to the first generation and get activity.
So I'm sure these assays would be difficult to access right now, do you think? I mean, in the situation where you have a patient, let's say this lady has disease progression, would you try erlotinib or gefitinib?
For sure. If I had no possibility to do a test or possibility to do a new biopsy, pragmatically I would try because I will evaluate efficacy in 1 month. And if it works, well, that's fantastic. And if it doesn't, probably I will roll over to some gentle chemotherapy like pemetrexed or something else.
So, you know, from my view, from 75,000 feet, so to speak, the story that we're hearing about these third generation agents, very effective, particularly mainly in T790 mutant situations, doesn't sound like there's much difference in efficacy, at least between these two. But you do see the glucose intolerance for ruxolitinib. I haven't really heard very much about problems with AZ9291. Is that kind of the way it's playing out?
It is partially that way, although I would say that apparently there is a little more rash and a little more interstitial lung disease reports with 9291 as compared to ruxolitinib. Now, to be frank, it is clear that hyperglycemia is not seen at all with AZD9291, and it's seen in around a quarter to a third of patients with ruxolitinib.
How much of a problem is the hyperglycemia? I've heard it's pretty easy to control with oral agents. Is that the case?
Hyperglycemia is in most of the cases well controlled with oral agents like metformin or others. One of the problems initially is that the pathophysiology of the hyperglycemia was not understood, and quite a few patients on ruxolitinib were treated with insulin, and that was a nightmare because the mechanism of action of hyperglycemia is a metabolite that is an insulin receptor and an IGF-1R receptor blocker. So you can throw as much insulin you want, hyperglycemia can only get worse. So what people need to understand is this is not the common hyperglycemia where you just call the endocrinologist who gives the lady a little nice shot of insulin. You need to give an oral drug.